This is The Country Hour, and you're with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
Hello, great to have you along. After 12:30 today, looking at the olive industry here in Western Australia and doing some really great things, achieving some great things, not only here, but overseas too, picking up a couple of prestigious gongs, one of them a gold medal at the New York International Olive Oil Competition. It sounds fancy. We'll have a look at that particular competition and what it means when you pick up a gold medal at those awards. Also, some market information today before the news at 1, checking in with the Mount Barker cattle yarding and looking at the prices with Tracy Kilner to go through those for you. And as you would have heard in the news today, the federal opposition says the time is up and all sheep exports must end. In a move that's marked a new policy for Labor, if elected, it's vowing to phase the trade out in under a decade. Now, the change in policy comes after the ABC yesterday revealed an exporter had warned the federal government sheep were at risk of dying at sea on some of these older ships. Those warnings came before almost 2,500 sheep died in an incident that shocked the nation. Brett Worthington is speaking with Labor Agriculture spokesman Joel Fitzgibbon.
We see a bright future for the meat processing sector and the value chain here in Australia, a bright future for producers. We believe we can increase their profitability, but we see no future for the live sheep export trade.
So to be clear, you would seek to ban live sheep exports if you are elected?
A Labor government will develop a red meat strategic industry plan. We will begin a transition, a plan to lift producer profitability, a transition to an end to live sheep exports, but a plan that both lifts producer profitability and creates more value and more jobs here in Australia.
This is quite an escalation in Labor policy. At the moment, you were suggesting a temporary suspension over the northern summer, but still supporting the trade more generally. So what's changed to make you want to move towards phasing it out entirely?
As you know, I extended a bipartisan hand to David Littleproud and members of the government. They've initiated a number of reviews. I've become frustrated by the slowness of those reviews, some of which won't report until after the next election. I've been frustrated by new reports about government inaction on standards and enforcement. And I was amazed when this week one of the exporters admitted that there are some circumstances in which large mortality rates on ships is unavoidable, something the exporters cannot do anything about. That is a game changer for me.
What time frame do you think it would take to phase this in?
Well, I said we accept that this will take a number of years. This has to be an orderly transition done in partnership with sheep farmers in particular. But while I accept that it will take a number of years, it can't be a decade. We must move more quickly than that because the market is changing too. And if we want sheep meat producers to have sustainable profitability, we need to start working on that transition now. Otherwise, the market will work against them in any case.
The farm sector has said it's concerned that they feel that moving to a boxed meat won't be able to give them the premium and give them the returns they're currently getting from live exports. What steps would you take to ensure that farmers can be making the money that they still are now?
Well, to suggest that we can't get the same premium from value adding here in Australia, chilled red meat in particular, than we do on live ex is just, I think, sadly and respectfully, an ignorance of where the market is heading.
Does this officially end the bipartisan approach to live exports then?
Well, certainly the bipartisanship is fraying at the edges. The government hasn't been able to control its own members. You have Susan Lee introducing a private members bill. David Littleproud was quite robust in his response in the beginning, but we haven't heard from him publicly for more than a week. Malcolm Turnbull has remained completely silent, and these reviews seem to be on the never-never, while at the same time we're getting continuing reports of severe breaches of standards, some of those reports now coming from some of the exporters themselves.
So will Labor support Susan Lee's bid to have the export industry banned?
We haven't even seen Susan Lee's bill, and Susan Lee's bill only gets into the parliament, I suspect, with the support of the government. I'm concentrating on Labor's responses, And the admission by the industry itself this week that there are some circumstances where high mortality rates are outside the control of the exporters, I think leaves us with no choice but to say we want to work with farmers and the value chain more generally to phase this sector out over time.
Federal Labor Agriculture spokesman Joel Fitzgibbon speaking to the ABC's Brett Worthington.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
10 past 12, that's what Matt has done. Matt says the live trade isn't in place because of the lack of cool stores or fridges in Asia and the Middle East. It is solely about meat processing getting done over there at an eighth of the price of a worker in Australia. No way would the target market overseas be able to afford to cover the costs of meat processed in Australia. Can someone within the industry finally stop the BS and front up and tell the truth and stop bleating? Pun intended. I'm a live export supporter. I'm just sick of being treated like an idiot. If any farmer had huge stock losses and footage of sheep dying like this, they'd be charged with animal cruelty and banned from owning livestock. Thank you for that, Matt. 0448 922 604 to text through this afternoon. Well, the Prime Minister has slammed Labor's promise to end live sheep exports. Malcolm Turnbull says the government is reviewing the way that the industry operates, and he says Labor's policy would cost jobs.
What the Labor Party has done today has just shown how reckless they are. We should make decisions about our big export industries with the benefit of science and information. We should do it on an informed basis, not an emotional one.
And the Minister for Agriculture, David Littleproud, has backed up those comments there by the Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, saying the McCarthy review into the Middle Eastern summer sheep trade is due in 2 weeks. With the science just 2 weeks away, Labor has rushed to a knee-jerk ban punishing farmers who've done no wrong. The Minister, Littleproud, goes on to say those farmers and businesses still traumatised by Labor's snap ban on live exports in 2011 must be tearing their hair out. Let me know this afternoon, 0448 922 604 to text through. Well, the RSPCA and Animals Australia have announced they will each contribute $500,000 to a farmer support fund to phase out live sheep exports. They're calling on the state and federal governments to join them to help farmers financially affected during the phase-out period. The RSPCA wants an immediate halt to sheep exports to the Middle East between May and the start of October. So that is 5 months of the year. Lynn Bradshaw, you and the RSPCA have been campaigning against the live animal trade for years. How are you reading the current debate about the trade?
I'm reading it as there has been a shift. We're talking about transition now officially. It's good to see some political leadership coming in, particularly here in Western Australia where live sheep export, we're doing the most of it. And that has been a significant change. So I'd like to call on all political leaders of all persuasions, to actually get together and do something about this dastardly trade.
Now, the industry and farmers on this program have been saying very loudly that there will be major financial implications for farmers if there is that pause, that suspension of the trade in the middle of the year, and some are saying that that will eventually lead to the banning of the trade if we do get that pause in the middle of the year. But we're already seeing those implications. If we look back at the sale yard, the markets in the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. the prices are already changing, not just yes. to do with what's going on with the uncertainty about the live trade, a few other factors in mm-hmm. there as well with mm-hmm. the dry conditions, mm-hmm. etc. Mm-hmm. But already, immediately, with uncertainty, the question mark, we see that change in the market. So if suddenly we see another 1.5 or 2 million sheep domestically mm-hmm. rather than going live mm-hmm. export, that domino effect seems pretty clear.
Yeah, I think uncertainty is a key, and this whole live export industry has been uncertain all the way through. We, of course, have been highlighting the issues since the late 1970s. But in terms of the price, you know, the live exporters, if you like, are underwriting by $10 to $20 per animal, the animals for live export. So it was good just now to hear Joel Fitzgibbon saying, let's value add, and it's all about that. Surely we can do better than this in this day and age.
Lynn Bradshaw, when we look back at the last significant upheaval in the sheep industry, it was the demise of the reserve price scheme back in 1991. And sales were suspended, and when they came back on, the drop was about 40%. Mm-hmm. In the end, we had a situation where farmers were being paid to shoot their sheep.
Yes.
Are you prepared to see that again this time round, if this is the next significant change?
No, and I don't think to go to the extremes. I mean, we really need now to have a look at exactly what's involved. We need to talk transition. We need to get the political will to actually go there, to set a timeline, to look at the implications and to work them through. And I'm sure with all the will and all the encouragement from people like myself, the RSPCA and other groups that have been involved in this, against this trade for such a long time, I'm sure, and with public support, that we can find alternatives.
One of the main anti-live animal export groups in New Zealand is calling for an end of all animal exports, including animals exported for breeding purposes. What's the RSPCA's view on that?
Well, it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because we do tend to focus on live animal export for slaughter. It seems that the export animals for slaughter are classed in some people's minds as a more inferior product and don't need to have the same care and attention as maybe breeding animals. But there's issues around breeding animals as well. You know, we're sending out dairy cows, for instance, to various countries and all sorts of other animals, which are, again, we're renowned in Australia for a quality product. So there's a whole set of other circumstances around sending breeding animals out.
So just to be clear, you do support the export of those animals for breeding purposes?
Only under the right circumstances.
One of the big criticisms when it comes to the groups who are anti-live animal export trade is the footage that comes forward. And the criticism is, why do the groups, like Animals Australia, for example, have this footage and seem to hang on to it, and then suddenly there's a big splash in the media, going back many years to the ABC's Four Corners story, A Bloody Business, and more recently on 60 Minutes with the sheep export story. What do you say to that criticism?
Well, I'd say that really the criticism, I can understand it, but it's unfounded in that I guess it's a last resort. It's quite frustrating. The RSPCA, for instance, has had a policy about live exports since its inception in the late 70s, and all the way through we've been campaigning, advocating for an end to it, on humane grounds only, obviously being an animal welfare organisation, but it's awfully frustrating to be able to have to see and provide information to politicians and to peak bodies in the farming industry where no action is taken.
How are you received when you make those approaches to the farm lobby groups here in WA or the farmers themselves?
Well, initially it's, you're just trying to put us out of business. You're all activists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Personally, for me now, in this latest episode, although it's, you know, horrific for the animals, I do feel vindicated on behalf of my colleagues, because we've been telling what's going on those ships and in this whole industry for a long time. The problem is, I believe that we haven't necessarily been aware that if we're dealing with key political industry groups that are lobby groups, if you will, that the messages aren't necessarily getting through to the farmers out there. So what I've chosen to instigate here in Western Australia is we are trying to communicate directly with farmers more. It's been very, very difficult when you're being vilified by certain of the peak bodies, when we try and work with them on a range of topics, not just necessarily on live animal export. It's really like a blocking mechanism. We're not anti-farming. And some of these political lobby groups have tried to portray us as that, which has actually done them a disservice and, I believe, has kicked farmers in the teeth. By the time something hits the media and it's all over the news and it's a major catastrophe, the horse is well and truly bolted. It's really too late. Whereas the messages we've been trying to give you have been there all the way along. And the message in this case in regard to long-haul live export of sheep is that it just can't work. And no matter how many reports you do, how many reviews, how many more conditions you impose, in the end it becomes an unviable business for exporters.
Lynn Bradshaw, thanks for coming into the studio today.
Okay.
Lynn Bradshaw, President of the RSPCA in WA, 20 past 12 on the Country Hour. Your comments coming through on the text this afternoon in response to what you heard moments ago, the federal opposition are saying that it's time now that all sheep exports must end. And this is a shift in policy for the Labor Party. If elected, it's vowing to phase the trade out in under a decade, and hearing earlier from Labor agricultural spokesman Joel Fitzgibbon. On the text, listening to Joel Fitzgibbon, I'm sorry, what? Let's look at the cultural influence on the global economy. There is more than 1.2 Muslims in the Middle East being the best trade partner for live export. Ramadan is coming up, and I'm pretty sure they don't believe in packaged meat as a religious ritual. This, our domestic market, is immaturely constructed compared to the global market. Just a reminder, put your name and where you're from. And this too. How many sheep die a day within Australia of all kind of causes? 500? 1,500? 2,500? Probably even more. These politicians need to pull their heads out of their backsides and let farmers get on with their jobs and let the live export carry on doing what they are doing, but maybe a little better. Thanks for that, Nigel. 0448 922 604 to be part of the conversation this afternoon.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Just before headlines at 12:30 today, let's have a look at the pork industry, because the word is Australia's producing too many pigs. Despite increased demand for pork, Australian farmers are growing more pigs than can be processed. Australian Pork's Andrew Spencer expects farmers will be forced to exit the industry as it encounters a new threshold of pain.
We've had pig prices pretty low for nearly 18 months now, and we know that this post-Easter period is one of the toughest times of year because we get high numbers of pigs. As the weather gets a bit cooler, pigs eat more, they grow quicker, and we get all of a sudden a flush of pigs onto the market and also some short weeks, which mean processing them can be a challenge. So we know it's a tough time of year. We know we've had tough prices, but it's really become worse in the last few weeks. And I think you could consider that the industry's going through a new threshold of pain for our producers. It's not only about low prices now, but for some of them, even finding a buyer to get rid of their pigs is becoming quite desperate. So, yes, it is very tough times in our industry.
Tell me about this, trying to find a buyer for pigs. Are there pigs that simply can't be processed at the moment?
They're pigs that aren't required. You know, we've got a problem that our supply to, as we've got Australian Bureau of Statistics information to the end of February, it's telling us that our pork production for the year to the end of February was 6% higher than it was for the same period the year before. So 6% is actually a lot of growth, and it's too much for our demand increases to keep up with. We know that consumers are enjoying pork more and more. They're eating more and more of it. We do have increases in consumption of maybe 3 to 4% year on year, but we can't get to 6%, and that means that that extra product puts pressure downward on price. So we've got producers selling pigs for less than cost of production, and with all these pigs around, some of them are just not required by the market. So producers get quite desperate. If you can't sell your pigs, they stay on the property. The property gets more and more pigs on it. They get overcrowded. There's all sorts of difficulties that pop up, including even potentially animal welfare issues.
Is it possible that some pigs are being slaughtered without going to market?
Look, I haven't heard that, and it's not an easy thing to do. Of course, there's all sorts of regulations around where and how you slaughter pigs, and most of that driven by food safety. So I haven't heard of that happening. You have to understand a lot of the larger producers out there do have very strong relationships with their buyers, and they're working with them constantly through these more difficult times to get the arrangements right for all parties. Where the really difficult end of the industry is at the smaller producer end, where they're dealing on the spot market. They're dealing in those extra few pigs that are around every week that someone might be able to do something with. And when pigs are scarce, those pigs are worth a lot of money. But when pigs are plentiful, those pigs can be worth very little money. And so the volatility at that small end of the market is huge. And that's the end that we're really focused on at the moment, because there are people who are financially hurting very seriously.
Do you think that we will see people exit the industry?
You know, in some ways, it's almost inevitable. You see market forces working. It doesn't make you feel any more comfortable because they're extremely cruel. And the problem we have with supply, you could argue, won't be fixed until people actually stop mating their sows and exit the industry. And for them, it's going to be a very, very difficult decision and a very painful one. So whilst, yes, it's probably going to happen, and yes, it's very cruel, it's probably also necessary for the market for the market to rebalance between supply and demand. And I would expect that decisions like that are being taken right now.
What about the role of APL at a time like this? Has it been irresponsible by promoting too much growth too rapidly?
There was a time when we were saying we needed more pigs in the market, and that was when our prices were up above $3.50. They peaked at somewhere around $3.70. At the time, we were very concerned that we would converting demand into high prices rather than converting demand into high consumption. So high prices is nice, but high prices don't have the same momentum and the same persistence that high consumption does. High consumption changes habits, and habit change is what our industry is really looking for, because we want increases in the volumes and the turnover and the income revenue for our industry. We want those to be sustainable and not just to come and go as prices go up and down. So we did need more pigs in the market. What's happened, of course, and what often happens in markets, is you get an overshoot. So everyone sort of plans on a few extra pigs at the same time, and instead of getting 2-3% growth in numbers, we get 6%. And that's just been too hard for the market. We also learned something, I guess, and that is that we have a very sensitive balance between supply and demand, and price adjusts itself extremely quickly.
27 past 12, Andrew Spencer, he's the chief executive at Australian Pork, talking there to the ABC's Kath Sullivan. Dawson Bradford has been in the pork industry pretty much his whole life, and he's the president of the WA Pork Producers Association. He runs 1,400 sows on his property, which is just north of Narrogin. Dawson, how would you describe the current circumstances in the pork industry here in WA?
Yeah, hi, Belinda. Certainly what Andrew is saying is true to a degree. Certainly the West Australian industry hasn't been hit as hard up till date as what the East Coast was, but certainly since Chinese New Year, that the market has softened and prices come back.
So why has it been different here in WA compared to the East that's been going through this for some time?
Well, we've tended to have a lot more flatter market. We've never reached the highs the East Coast normally get, but we quite often don't get the lows that the East Coast get. So ours has always been a more stable market, but in the current situation, yeah, we're going just as low as what the East Coast is now.
Give us a sense of that, from where the prices were to where they are today, and how what that shift has been.
Yeah, well, prices probably come off 20-25% since Christmas. So yeah, it's quite a drop.
So how do you weather that? How does a business like yours make adjustments in a period where, in just a few months, the price drops by 20-25%?
Yeah, well, it's not easy for the smaller producers or the family operators. We tend to run a pretty efficient ship as it is, but so we've just got to look at reducing costs, take out any feed additives that we don't need, but we've got to make sure we don't drop the performance of the animals. Otherwise, that will impact on the bottom line. We can't cut staff because we've got all the welfare regulations we've got to meet. So,
and you can only tighten so far, I guess. I mean, it reaches a point, and as we heard earlier, I mean, he is convinced that some will leave the industry. Is that going to be the case here in WA?
Yeah, well, I certainly think the smaller guys, there's pressure on now to try and reduce numbers. But the trouble with that, once you start reducing the numbers, your cost of your overheads on your existing animals go up. So if you take a lower price on the ones you're left with, and end up with a higher overhead cost. So it's a real double whammy. The key is The key is export. We've got to get some export markets, and that's probably the fault of the industry over the last 4 or 5 years. We've had Singapore, but it's been flooded now.
What about this text from Helen is saying that there's just too much imported American pork meat?
Yeah, well, there certainly is a big percentage of imported meat. That's for the processing industry. We do push for free trade around the world, so we've got to live with that. So we've got to be efficient, but we've just got to make sure that we're competing on a level playing field in terms of welfare requirements and this sort of stuff. But we'll never be able to match the pricing of the rest of the world. We are high cost producers, but we are a clean green industry, so that is our selling point into Asia.
As you said earlier, markets are going to be the key, finding new markets to get the product, home for the product into the future. But is the local industry getting together, the producers themselves or the processors getting together to nut out a plan here in WA?
Yeah, well, I think everybody's sweating on China at the moment. There's no export protocol into there at the moment. And this is something that should have been done years ago, unfortunately, but it's easy to say that in hindsight. But, so they are looking at Korea and Japan. Papua New Guinea is a very low cost just to try and get some meat out of the country to balance up the local demand.
Dawson, great to have you on the Country Hour this afternoon. Thanks for being part of it. Dawson Bradford, a pig producer just north of Narrogin. He's also the president of the WA Pork Producers Association.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio, WA.
And Michaela Carr in the studio with the news headlines.
Hi, Belinda. The Prime Minister has slammed Labor's promise to end live sheep exports. The federal opposition says it will phase out the industry within a decade if it wins power. Malcolm Turnbull says the government is reviewing the way the industry operates and Labor's policy would cost jobs. The Law Council of Australia is raising privacy concerns about a government push for a new identity matching system. The technology would give government departments and police the ability to identify faces in large crowds. WA police will review 53,000 speeding fines issued since February after it was found the new speed cameras, which captured them, may produce faulty readings. And Cricket Australia boss James Sutherland says the next coach of the national men's team was always going to be Australian. Justin Langer will coach all three formats of the game for 4 years, guiding the teams through two Ashes series, a World Cup and a World T20 tournament. WA's loss is Australia's gain.
It wasn't a surprise when we heard the news come through.
No, it wasn't.
Not to anyone.
Yeah, and I think he really agonised over it. He has quite a young family, but he really is, I think, just in the box seat as the best person to put integrity back into the game. So good luck, JL.
It's going to be great to see how the changes, I guess, under his leadership when it all kicks off.
And they're needed too, so yeah. I think he's definitely the man for the job.
Michaela, thank you for that, and a full bulletin for you coming your way at 1 o'clock today here on ABC WA. Still to come, we'll get to those really great awards that were picked up by some of the olive oil producers here in Western Australia. That's not far away. And the market results to the Mount Barker cattle market. Tracy Kilner along shortly with those details. And also the GM parliamentary inquiry into that possibility of some sort of mechanism to compensate for those farmers who say they've been contaminated or GM material come onto their particular properties. That continues in Perth today. And we'll get some of the latest presentations to that parliamentary inquiry in just a moment or two. Off to the Weather Bureau right now, Noel Pusey is having a look at the charts for you this afternoon. How's it looking on northern and eastern parts of the charts there, Noel?
Oh, it's pretty quiet at the moment. Sort of high pressure ridge lies over sort of southern parts of the state. Fairly fresh easterly burst of winds moving through the Pilbara and the northern Gascoyne, probably the interior as well, for the next few days. It's fairly fresh in the mornings there with easterly winds, but little in the way of thunderstorm activity at the moment. Fairly clear through the Kimberley, the Pilbara, and really through eastern parts of the state for the next 3 days at least. Little activity starting to appear perhaps during Sunday through the goldfields and then down into the Eucla on Monday as a low-pressure system develops south of the state and then moves east along the south coast. So that'll affect the weather for the southwest corner for the next 4 days.
Let's have a look into the Southwest Land Division then, Noel.
Okay, well, it's a pretty pretty clear over most parts at the moment. The ridge maintaining a southwesterly flow along the south coast, though, with some shower activity in near southern coastal parts along the Euclid Coast, and that will continue effectively for tomorrow as well. So mainly light falls here, but things should start to ease a little bit later on Friday as the high-pressure ridge and the higher centre starts to move towards the Bight. We do have this low approaching from the west during Saturday, so winds are tending quite warm northerly over much of the South Land Division and adjacent areas ahead of the low and the mid-level cloud associated with that too. That'll start to stream in sort of late Saturday night into Sunday morning. Some mid-level shower activity likely over the southwest capes, extending through sort of really to Durian Bay to Hopetown, something like that, through the morning on Sunday, and then further east through the afternoon and evening to cover most of the South Land Division. Only light falls, though, over central and eastern parts. I don't really think it's the start of the winter growing season yet, unfortunately. But fairly fresh northerly winds and northwesterly winds associated with the low, particularly hitting the west coast through Sunday afternoon into the evening. There's a risk of some showers and thunderstorms and more moderate falls around that southwest corner as the low probably gets closest to Albany, but remaining south of the state there. But quite gusty winds expected probably through Sunday into the early hours of Monday morning. Shower activity then starting to contract to the south coast and into the goldfields, and then the Euclid, as I mentioned before, during Monday afternoon and evening.
Any warnings, Noel?
Yes, we have strong wind and gale warnings for the south coast, an easing trend on that for the Esperance Coast and the Euclid Coast, easing from the west. But strong wind warnings at the easterly flow off the Pilbara Coast and also for the West Kimberley Coast for the next day or two probably.
Thanks a lot for those details, Noel. On ABC WA, this is the Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you, and it's 24 to 1. Richard Hudson in the studio now just to go through the rainfall figures for you. How's it looking?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'd love to have some better news, but as you probably know, if you haven't got much in your own rain gauge, there hasn't been much around in any part of the state, certainly nothing at all in the Kimberley, Pilbara, Gascoyne, a tiny bit in the interior, nothing in the goldfields, only a tiny bit in the Eucla, nothing on the islands. In the central west, Barberton had 5 and then nothing anywhere at all. In the lower west, Bickley had 5 and then the rest, there's about 30 rainfall recording locations, had between 1 and 4 mils, but nothing else, either 5 or over. In the southwest, the top is Shannon that had 4. Wokalup had 6. And then Shannon with 4 and then nothing. In the southern coastal region, Shane Beach 7, Dalyup Park 18, Denmark 8, Erin Air 14, Esperance at the airport 10, Esperance Downs 8, King River 5, Mount Barker the same, Oakmarsh Farm 13, Pleasant Valley 11, and Tallina Downs had 9. And then for the central wheat belt and Great Southern, the top unfortunately is only 1 mil.
Thanks for that, Richard. 23 to 1 earlier in the hour, talking about the fact that the RSPCA and Animals Australia have announced they will each contribute $500,000 to a farmer support fund to phase out live sheep exports. Murray in South Yalbini says Animals Australia is prepared to spend $500,000 to rid a necessary industry for Western Australian farmers. I'd be happy if they wanted to help me pay my $3,000 per week for feed and hay that I've been doing for the last 8 weeks and potentially many months more if we don't have substantial rain soon. And on the topic of live export trade, this from Nathan: putting a blanket ban on live export is such a counterproductive way to approach the issue. They are probably ways we can improve the quality of live export, but a blanket ban won't help improve a trade that we as farmers heavily depend on. Drink driving is a national issue as well, but the government doesn't put a blanket ban on driving. Instead, they implement strategies to educate and improve those who drive. How about we take the same approach with the live export trade? Because implementing a total ban will be a massive misread by the government. ABC WA, 22 to 1.
The Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
The Senate Committee Parliamentary Inquiry into genetically modified issues resumed today in Perth. Now, this is the one that's trying to figure out if farmers should be compensated for any economic losses suffered due to contamination from genetically modified material. And if so, What sort of mechanisms could provide that compensation? So farmers and farm lobby groups are in Parliament House today to make their presentations. And in his opening speech, the Pastoralists and Graziers Association's Gary McGill questioned the need for this inquiry at all.
Firstly, the words mechanisms for compensation for economic loss falsely assumes that there is a real risk that farmers will suffer economic loss as a result of contamination by genetically modified material. Secondly, the heading assumes that GM plant material is capable of causing contamination. Thirdly, the heading assumes falsely that all farmers, not restricted to organic farmers, are at risk. Fourthly, it is implicit in the heading that there is a general call by farmers in Western Australia for a compensation system. The uncontradicted evidence at the Marsh versus Baxter trial, which was accepted by Justice Kenneth Martin, was that the GM canola material is harmless to humans, animals, soil and plants. Such finding was based on undisputed scientific evidence from a world expert in that field of science.
Duncan Young has also spoken this morning, and he is the WA Farmers Grain Section President. And one of his main points was most problems are easily resolved between farmers.
I mean, it's a bit like a neighbour giving you lice in your sheep. I've had that a couple of times. And we came to an arrangement where he paid for the treatment of the lice treatment. So it wasn't a big issue, but... yeah, they're normally resolved. Most people get on. I think the only times it wouldn't be is if there's a situation where neighbours just don't get on. The vice versa can be the same as well. What happens with if an organic farm, weeds come off that farm and go on to a conventional farm? It's got to be looked both ways.
Yeah.
So, and especially with... disease risks are quite high when it comes to that. And I'm not saying one system is better than the other, because I firmly believe you should be able to farm however you want. And if you want to farm organically, then you should be entitled to farm organically. Same as if you want to farm conventionally, you should be entitled to farm conventionally.
WA Farmers Grain Section President Duncan Young. And that parliamentary inquiry, the hearing set to continue. We're yet to hear from anyone representing just the organic industry, but you will know about that when that happens. We'll let you know here on the Country Hour. ABC WA, it's 18 to 1. Well, a couple of small Western Australian olive oil producers have just taken out some prestigious awards. One is produced from olives grown in the state's Midwest, and I'll tell you more about that in just a moment or two. But olive oil produced on a small grove at Nanup, which is 70 kilometres east of Margaret River, has just won the gold medal at the New York International Olive Oil Competition. And it's been produced by Mick O'Callaghan at Nanup. And Mick thinks one of the secrets to their success is they're smaller than most producers, so they can concentrate on the small things. And collectively, he says that makes a difference.
The olive oil is special because it's cold grown. We've matched the soil type with the olives we wanted to grow. We've matched the climate to the olives we wanted to grow. It's been a targeted process over, over 12 years to get an oil that tastes like what we've got. And I used to get a consultant out of Italy. He used to come every year, but he's retired. And about 6 years ago, he said to me, "Well, you make nice oil, Mick, but a lot of people in the world make nice oil. You've got to change it up if you want to win the big awards." We planted 400 trees of another variety that gives it a bit more length in the taste and an aroma that's specific to that variety. So, as I say, it's 12 years and a lot of hard work and a lot of planning going into it.
So take me to where you were and how you felt when the news came through that you'd actually won this.
You probably understand I was pretty over the moon hitting a target like that, because it is one of the world's best olive oil competitions, and it's probably a culmination of about 12 years work to get it to a point where we can get our oil benchmarked against global oils, which are the best in the world.
And I suppose, you've only got a little grove down in Nanup, and you're going up against some of these big commercial producers. Do you think that kind of homegrown family business gave you the edge?
A lot of things give me the edge. We don't have the resources to compete with the big blokes. They have specific parts of their grove that they pick and manage for these awards. They have a team of people that blend it and target what the judges want. But our little grove of 2,000 trees, our oil was a representative sample of what we grow. We didn't blend it. We didn't manipulate the taste by any other means, but we picked the whole grove, it's crushed, and that's what we make. That's our standard oil. That's the oil we make. It's not a contrived oil for a show. I've got three young daughters who help run the grove. They're ages 3, 8, and 10, and we all pack the oil to go to the show. We've poured it in the bottles. We put the caps on. We've wrapped it in bubble wrap and put it in the box, and my three-year-old daughter rode a night and put it on the back. Subsequently, we took it off with a nice picture of the olive grove. So it's, we all had a crack at getting it over there.
Now, you run your grove and your business a little bit different to some other commercial olive farmers, don't you?
Well, there's margins in the olive game are fairly tight. So we and a few other groves have taken on a collaborative approach to olive production, which means we all share resources, whether it be machines, labour resources, experience and knowledge, and we cooperate. Some things don't go well, some things go really well. So when things don't go well, we all have an understanding of what's going on, and we don't get too upset. We just find out ways we can get over it and improve. And yeah, I think you can either operate as competitors or cooperate, and choosing the cooperative model really works for us.
How did these kind of this collaborative relationship with all these, your grove and others, come about?
I do a lot of contract work and meet a lot of people, and just happened along, you know, we've just formed relationships, and we all trust each other. Nothing's written down, it's all verbal and on a handshake. And the people that own these olive groves are fairly knowledgeable. They've all got a fairly good business acumen. So, we're just sort of mates, all like red wine, all like having a challenge, and growing olives is a challenge, and getting good olive oil is a dead hard challenge. So we all take the challenge on and all enjoy what we do.
Oh, well done. Nanup olive grower Mick O'Callaghan speaking to John Daly about his award-winning olive oil. And Western Australia's most northern commercial olive groves has also won a big award. Nestled among the rolling hills of Chapman Valley in the Midwest, Russell and Mari Lewis have just taken out the award for Best Oil in Australia. That's at the Olive Japan Awards. Like Mick O'Callaghan, the Lewises have a relatively small-scale operation, about 6,000 trees or so. And Joe Prendergast headed out to the grove and interrupted Russell as he harvested their 13th crop.
G'day, Russell.
Hey, how are you going, Joe?
I'm good. What are you up to?
Shaking a few olive trees.
You've just started harvest?
Yeah, that's right, 2 days ago.
How's it going?
It's a bit of a light year this year after a very big year last year, so that was expected. We'll probably have about 20% of what we had last year. A lot of trees will even have nothing on them. We won't harvest a third to a half of them. Hopefully next year they'll be up again. So they seem to alternate beer in 2 or 3 year cycles. I'm not sure. There's different opinions on that.
These trees that I've interrupted you harvesting, they look lovely. You've got a variety of colours in the fruit that's on the tree. What variety are you harvesting here?
These are Queen of Spain, and all varieties seem to ripen unevenly. Like they all go from green to black. So we're just picking, going through the trees with it. One thing you can do with a shaker is drive just reverse down the lines and pick off the trees you want to pick this week and the rest next week and so on.
Russell, the tree shaker that you're using has a bib that basically folds around underneath the tree, and the olives fall into that when you shake the tree. So it's a fascinating process, but you started picking a couple of days ago. How long will it take you to harvest all of your crop this year?
About 300-400 trees a day, probably 10 days, I suppose, if we do two-thirds of them. But when it's a light crop, I'm talking 5 kilos per tree, I can go and go through, 300 trees just to get 1.5 tonnes. So it's no big deal at the end of the day to process them as well.
Well, you must be doing something right because you've just won the Best of Australia category at the Olive Japan Awards. You must be pretty pleased.
Well, just awards help trying to market in a difficult business, I suppose, where we don't have the luxury of poolings and what have you like the grain industry has, where you've got to go and catch what you can. We go into different shows to try and get some recognition, and we thought we'd have a go at Japan this year, and hoping to get silver or gold would be nice, a bonus. And out of 27 entries from Australia, we actually got best from Australia, so that was certainly more than I expected.
Yeah, you cleaned off on your first attempt, didn't you?
Yeah, that was, I mean, we're probably lucky on the day with the judges taking a liking to a variety that is normally pickled. So we were the only ones from all entries from in the world, in fact, with the Queen of Spain in there. So maybe that the difference there appealed to them, I don't know.
I think you're being a bit modest here. What's the secret to producing a good oil?
Still learning every year with this, but despite conventional wisdom that olive trees are hardy, which is right, they won't die if you turn the water off, but they still, like anything, need looking after. So the most important part about fertilising is, for happy trees, is to not so much get yield, but to keep them disease resistant. I think part of the secret to making good oil is to don't bash it more than you have to. Most presses seem to have a vertical separator afterwards, which just cleans the oil up a bit at the time, but gives it a hell of a hiding in the process, which is not really necessary because all of the residue settles out of oil pretty well after a month or two.
Is there something special about going through the process yourself, picking, and then going through processing the olives and making the oil?
Yeah, probably. You do get used to these things. I come from Broadacre, where you grow a wheat crop or an annual crop, and at Christmas time, if you want to do something different next year, it's simple. Just plant something different. But short of pulling these things out, you sort of wake up next year and they're still there. So I'm lucky. It's a good break from the office job, I suppose.
I bet it is. That's Russell Lewis. He's from Chapman River Olives, taking a break from the office and from shaking his olive trees to speak to the ABC's Joe Prendergast. So congratulations, taking out Best Oil in Australia. That's Russell Lewis. And just before, you heard from Mick O'Callaghan, who's taken out the Gold Award at the New York Olive Oil Awards. So that story, in fact, on the ABC's WA Country Hour Facebook page. So go and have a look at that to get some more information. And many of you taking the opportunity just to congratulate Mick on his big prize. Fantastic result, tall man, says Beth. And many more notes of congratulations too. So you can pick up on that story there on the WA Country Hour Facebook page. Earlier in the hour, talking about live exports and the fact that the Labor Party, Federal Labor, has changed its stance on its position on live animal export trade, saying that it's would rather see the phase out of the industry and in under 10 years' time. That's what Joel Fitzgibbon was saying, the agriculture spokesman, saying earlier in the hour. A few of you keen to have your say on that, on live export. Paul in Jerramungup says, RSPCA, Labor Party, Animals Australia do not derive their income from stock sales. These do-gooders have no regard for producers. They're living in a dreamland if they think banning live X will not have an impact on price. Supply and demand comes into play. Should this proceed, it is high time producers took action against these organisations in the form of a class action for lost income. The consequences of their actions should be brought home to them. Thanks for that, Paul. Another text saying, why don't they mention the 1,697,500 sheep that were exported in excellent condition? And this, it shows how much they don't know. $500,000 won't compensate one farm. It will take billions off land value Australia-wide and kill rural Australia. That's in reference to the fact, the announcement today that Animals Australia and the RSPCA are willing to put forward $500,000 each as a sort of transition compensation fund towards the farming community. ABC WA, it is 6 minutes to one. The market's not far away. Tracy Kilner along with the Mount Barker results in just a moment.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Elizabeth Jackson. On the program today, the Commonwealth Bank in damage control after admitting it lost the records for almost 20 million accounts. The corruption scandal rocking a major Queensland council. And how will the new cricket coach, Justin Langer, help the Australian team recover from the ball tampering scandal?
I think one of the things that's really important is that we keep looking to earn respect. To me, respect's worth more than all the gold in the world, so earn respect on and off the cricket field.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
Five to one, 5 minutes away from the news at 1 o'clock, and then The World Today for you. Right now, to the markets. No cattle sale at Mount Barker last week. Tracy Kilner is at today's sale. And Tracy, what were numbers like compared to the sale just a couple of weeks ago?
Hi, Belinda. Numbers were down this week for a total yarding of 1,367 mixed quality cattle. The yarding was dominated by young cattle with a large number of store cattle on offer. Steers lifted in value while the heifers eased on quality. Cows gained 8 to 10 cents a kilo with a top price of 226 for heavy fat cows, and store cows topped at 206 cents a kilo. Grown steers weighing 500 to 600 kilos sold for 270 cents, while the lighter 400 to 500 kilo range made from 260 to 282 cents a kilo. Grain assisted heavy yearling steers made from 284 to 286, while medium weight yearling steers sold for 272 to 318 cents, and the lightweight steers from 300 to 324 cents. The yearling heifers eased, making from 206 to 268 cents a kilo. Weaner steers over 330 kilos gained 7 cents, making from 280 to 322 cents a kilo. The lighter weight sold from 290 to 364 cents. Weaner heifers eased on quality, selling from 210 to 274 cents a kilo. The heavy prime cows gained 8 cents, selling from 198 to 226. Medium weights made from 200 to 214 cents. And the store cows sold for 120 cents for light plain cows, up to 206 cents for better quality stores. The heavy bulls remained firm, selling for 180 to 196 cents. Medium weights made from 144 to 172 cents. And lightweight bulls sold for 222 to 272 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks a lot for the details, Tracy. That pretty much wraps up the livestock markets for this week. But I think it's going to be Danny Burkett along tomorrow. I think he's back on deck. We'll find out anyway this time tomorrow on the Country. I'm going to go through the wool market results. If it's not Danny, it's probably going to be Tony anyway. So one way or another, we'll wrap up the wool market sales for you tomorrow. ABC WA, this is the Country Hour. Belinda Varaschetti with you just for a few more minutes or so. It's 3 minutes to one, and a sneak peek at what some of what we'll be talking about with you on the program tomorrow. A special segment looking at how people in more remote parts of Western Australia are using social media to bridge that rural-city divide. As urban centres are growing, Australians are becoming increasingly disconnected to life on farms and stations. But social media is slowly changing that trend. So tomorrow I thought we would have a special panel discussion for you with some northern cattle producers who are using platforms like Facebook and Instagram to try and get that message across, to educate consumers in the city about where their food and fibre comes from, and also about issues like live exports.
Instagram for me has been a big one, just showing what we do. I think creating a brand so that people can see where their food's coming from, how it's being produced, and the producers not forgetting or remembering that everyday things for them isn't normal for their consumer. With over 80% of Australia's population being in cities and urban areas, they don't see calf drinking from mum, or you know, a nice cow in the sunset, or the sunset behind a nice cotton crop and things like that. I think they forget those nice things that people really do want to see, because they want to know where their food and the story from paddock to plate.
That look at that movement, at the special discussion about how social media trying to bridge that divide between city and more regional rural parts of Australia, that's on the Country Hour tomorrow. The big story today, though, and leading the hour, is the news that Labor has changed its stance on live animal exports and saying that if it wins power, it's going to proceed with banning of the trade, a phase out of the trade, and it won't be 10 years, it will be less than that period. So in under 10 years, a phase out of the live animal export trade. A link to that story on the WA Country Hour Facebook page for you to have a look through in more detail. And these comments are just some of the ones already gathering there if you'd like to be part of the conversation. Stuart says, was thinking about giving Labor a chance to sort out the GST, but not now. Pauline says they want to win the next election. And this from Annabelle Coppen. As a farmer, I travelled the world and lived and breathed the live export trade supply chain for over 3 years, and the latest campaign has highlighted the worst of this trade. There are so many amazing stories and outcomes of this trade for both Australians and the people receiving in the countries, and far more than the negative ones we see on 60 Minutes. You can be part of that conversation on the WA Country Hour Facebook page. A link to that story and Labor's change of its stance on live exports for you to have a read through. News time now, it's 1 o'clock.